Most world leaders can't summon a civilian army willing to die for them. But Christopher Doodoo's Coke wasn't a politician. He was Jamaica's most feared and beloved Don. His kingdom wasn't built in parliament. It was carved out of concrete and blood in Tivoli Gardens, where bullets were law and loyalty meant survival. The son of the infamous Jim Brown, Doodoo inherited more than power. He inherited a legacy of silence, ruthlessness, and political protection that reached from West Kingston to Washington, D.C. He didn't need cameras or interviews. His orders echoed louder than any election speech. But when the United States demanded his extradition, the truth of Jamaica's underground rule exploded into public view. The government hesitated, people armed themselves, and what followed, the 2010 Tivoli Gardens massacre, was the bloodiest internal conflict in modern Jamaican history. Over 70 civilians died. The government nearly collapsed. So why did an entire community go to war to protect a criminal? And why did it take so long for the world to see that Doodoo wasn't just a gangster? He was the shadow prime minister. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Son of the System. To understand Christopher Doodoo Coke, you have to understand what he inherited and who he inherited it from. His father, Lester Lloyd Coke, better known as Jim Brown, wasn't just a Don. He was a myth, a brutal, charismatic strongman who turned the West Kingston community of Tivoli Gardens into his fortress and the base of operations for what would become one of the most feared criminal organizations in the Western Hemisphere, the Shower Posse. Why Shower? Some say it referred to how the gang showered enemies with bullets. Others say it was a nod to the abundance of guns and cash that flowed from the United States back into Jamaica, as if from a shower of blessings. Either way, the name would come to symbolize mass murder, international trafficking, and the blurred line between gangsters and government. The garrison barn of blood and politics Tivoli Gardens wasn't just a slum. It was a political garrison, a stronghold built by the ruling Jamaica Labour Party, JLP, during the 1960s. In exchange for loyalty, the residents of Tivoli were given protection, jobs, and services by dons who acted as warlords with unofficial state power. Jim Brown ruled Tivoli with iron fists and open palms. He distributed food and money. He paid for funerals. He protected his people. And in turn, they protected him. His loyalty to the JLP was legendary. So close was his relationship with Edward Seaga, the then Prime Minister of Jamaica, that many residents whispered he was untouchable. But Jim Brown's reign came to a violent, suspicious end. In 1992, as he awaited extradition to the U.S. on drug and gun charges, he burned to death in his cell at the General Penitentiary in Kingston. Officially, it was ruled accidental, but in Jamaica, very little, especially in prison, is accidental. Many believed he was silenced to protect politicians or to prevent him from testifying in the U.S. That's when Christopher Michael Coke, just 23 years old, stepped out of the shadows. A prince raised in two worlds. Unlike his father, Doodoo was educated. He attended Arden High School in Jamaica, one of the island's more prestigious institutions. He later traveled to the United States for schooling, reportedly living in New York and Florida, where the Shower Posse already had firm roots. By the mid-1990s, with his father dead and many of his rivals weakened, Doodoo returned to Tivoli Gardens and quietly assumed control, but he didn't roar into power with bravado. He moved like a CEO, not a gangster. No flashy chains, no loud declarations. His operations ran like a tight corporation, and he expected loyalty, discretion, and absolute efficiency. He used the reputation of Jim Brown, the infrastructure of the Shower Posse, and a sophisticated understanding of international logistics to grow his empire. cocaine, firearms, extortion, contract killings, and money laundering flowed between Kingston, Miami, Toronto, and New York, carried out by lieutenants who were feared across the diaspora. What made Dudas different wasn't just his discipline. It was his calculated balance of terror and charity. The Don Who paid your light bill. Ask any Tivoli Gardens resident who Dudas was, and the answers would vary. To law, enforcement, he was a transnational criminal. To the U.S. Justice Department, he was a major threat to urban stability in three countries. But to Tivoli, he was a father figure, a provider, and the only functioning authority many had ever known. Dudas paid school fees for children. He handed out food during Christmas. He settled disputes. If a woman's house was leaking, she didn't call a contractor. She called the Don. The Jamaican government had long failed to provide consistent services to inner-city communities like Tivoli. Dudas filled that vacuum, and he filled it with conditions, loyalty, silence, obedience. He was like God. One resident later said, people would die for him, and they did. He enforced that loyalty with violence when necessary. Killings were swift, silent, and rarely questioned. Snitches disappeared, rival gangs were eliminated or absorbed, and anyone who crossed Dudas didn't get a warning. They got a funeral. But beyond the garrison, the pressure was building. America's quiet war on Dudas. By the late 2000s, the United States had been tracking Christopher Koch for over a decade. The DEA had compiled wiretaps, witness testimony, and intercepted shipments tied directly to Koch's network. A sealed indictment was issued in 2009, charging him with racketeering, conspiracy to traffic cocaine and marijuana, and conspiracy to traffic firearms. But here's where it gets politically radioactive. The U.S. submitted an official request to Jamaica, extradite Christopher Koch, and for the first time in years, the Jamaican government hesitated openly. Then Prime Minister Bruce Golding, head of the JLP, initially refused. He cited concerns about the legality of the wiretaps used in the indictment, but everyone knew the truth. Extraditing Dudas meant betraying a man whose gang had delivered votes, suppressed rival party areas, and controlled a key JLP constituency. Golding's hesitation triggered a firestorm. The media accused the administration of protecting a criminal. The U.S. grew increasingly aggressive in its public demands. Civil society groups protested, and Dudas, he vanished. The breaking point. In May 2010, Golding relented. Under massive political and diplomatic pressure, he signed the extradition order. The moment the ink dried, Wes, Kingston erupted. Barricades went up around Tivoli Gardens. Armed men, many just teenagers, took to the rooftops with rifles. The entire community dug in, preparing for war. Schools shut down, businesses closed, residents stockpiled food. They weren't preparing to riot. They were preparing to die for Dudas. The government responded with brute force. On May 24, 2010, the Jamaican Defense Force, JDF, and police launched a full military operation to capture Dudas. The target, Tivoli Gardens. What followed was nothing short of a civilian massacre. The Tivoli Gardens incursion tanks rolled through narrow streets. Soldiers kicked down doors. Helicopters hovered overhead. The firefight lasted 3 days. Bodies lined sidewalks. Homes were riddled with bullets. Communications were cut. Journalists were blocked. The state imposed a media blackout on key areas. By the time the smoke cleared, over 70 civilians were dead, many of them unarmed. Human rights groups accused the Jamaican government of extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances, and torture. The people had resisted, but Dudas, he escaped again. The manhunt intensified. Rumors swirled. He'd fled to Haiti. He was in the hills. He was hiding in plain sight. Roadblocks were everywhere. Kingston was locked down. For weeks, Dudas remained invisible, caught in a wig and a bulletproof vest. On June 22, 2010, the search ended. At a checkpoint near 6 miles in St. Catherine, police stopped a car. Inside was a man wearing a woman's wig, thick glasses, and a bulletproof vest. It was Christopher Koch. He didn't resist. He asked for one thing, to be taken to the U.S. Embassy, not Jamaican prison. He knew what happened to his father. The government honored his request. He was flown to New York days later, where he pleaded not guilty at first, then changed his plea to guilty of conspiracy to traffic narcotics and conspiracy to commit racketeering. In 2012, he was sentenced to 23 years in U.S. federal prison. And yet, even in shackles, Dudas remains a legend. Chapter 2, Fallout and Legacy. The dust had barely settled on Tivoli Gardens when the real reckoning began. Over 70 civilians were dead. Hundreds more were injured. The official government narrative claimed that these were collateral casualties in a necessary war against criminality. But on the ground, in the alleyways and blood-stained homes of West Kingston, the people told a different story. They had been invaded, not liberated. And the man at the center of it all, Christopher Dudas Koch, was no longer in Jamaica. Political detonation. For Prime Minister Bruce Golding, the operation that removed Dudas also nearly destroyed his political career. Leaked information revealed that Golding had secretly hired U.S. law firm Manat, Phelps & Phillips to lobby the Obama administration to withdraw the extradition request, a move that violated diplomatic norms and fueled accusations of deep ties between the state and criminal underworld. The Manat-Dudas scandal, as it came to be known, dominated Jamaican headlines for months. Golding's credibility was shattered. He publicly apologized, saying he had acted out of loyalty to his party and fear of what Dudas might reveal if extradited. But it wasn't enough. By 2011, he was forced to resign, marking one of the rare cases where a Don's arrest indirectly toppled a Democratic leader. What became crystal clear to the Jamaican public was this. Dudas wasn't just a Don. He was part of the system. Who really controls Jamaica? The incursion and its aftermath exposed what many had whispered for decades. Jamaica is not fully run by the people elected to office. Rather, there exists a shadow government of Dons, criminal leaders who control votes, distribute resources, and enforce order in neglected communities. These Dons, in turn, often receive protection, sometimes directly, sometimes implicitly, from the political class. This symbiotic relationship is called garrison politics, and it is uniquely Jamaican in form, though familiar to other post-colonial societies with deep inequality and fractured institutions. Dudas mastered this system. He ruled Tivoli not just with guns, but with governance. He provided electricity when JPS cut it off. He ensured order during blackouts. He arbitrated land disputes, organized community events, and gave out loans with lower interest than any Jamaican bank. And if you defied him, your punishment was swift and irreversible. The transnational reach Dudas wasn't just local. His power extended to New York, Miami, and Toronto, where branches of the Shower Posse continued operations long after his extradition. In the U.S., the Shower Posse had been under surveillance for decades, implicated in over 1,400 murders during the 1980s and 1990s alone. Their reach into Caribbean immigrant neighborhoods was so deep that they were often both feared and protected by local populations. Why? Because Dudas used migrant loyalty the same way he used political loyalty at home. Shower Posse members abroad sent money back to Tivoli, coordinated weapons shipments, and carried out hits on rival groups or disobedient lieutenants. He had lieutenants across multiple states, safe houses in Brooklyn, allies in Toronto's Jane Finch corridor. Christopher Koch was a CEO of a narco state, and the Tivoli Gardens brand was his headquarters. Even after his arrest, U.S. authorities worried that he could continue directing operations from behind bars. Life in U.S. custody. In 2012, Duda stood before a U.S. federal judge and calmly accepted a 23-year sentence after pleading guilty to racketeering conspiracy and conspiracy to commit assault with a dangerous weapon. He admitted that he had ordered attacks on people he believed threatened his organization. He confirmed his leadership role in a violent international drug ring, but he stopped short of naming collaborators, either in Jamaica or abroad. That silence may have saved lives, or it may have sealed the fate of others. Today, Dudas is held in a federal correctional facility in Illinois, reportedly in isolation. He is expected to be released in 2034, unless transferred or granted early release for good behavior. By then, he will be in his 60s. But his name remains a whisper in Kingston streets. Not gone, just waiting. The ghost of Tivoli. For the residents of Tivoli Gardens, the legacy of Dudas is complicated. Some mourn his absence. The social structure he built, violent though it was, kept crime from rival gangs largely at bay. After his capture, homicides in West Kingston actually increased as power vacuums opened and new contenders tried to assert dominance. Others remain traumatized. Survivors of the 2010 incursion still report PTSD, nightmares, and mistrust of the state. Children watched neighbors die. Families were displaced. Evidence of extrajudicial executions, including gunshot wounds at close range, was presented to the West Kingston Commission of Inquiry, but few convictions followed. For years, Dudas's lieutenants attempted to fill the void, but none carried the same balance of fear and reverence. He had become a ghost leader, absent but omnipresent. The cocaine power politics triangle. At its core, Dudas's rise wasn't a story of one man's ambition. It was a case study in what happens when post-colonial neglect, Cold War politics, and capitalist drug economies collide in a single island. During the 1980s, Jamaica became a Cold War pawn. The U.S. supported right-wing political factions, fearing the spread of socialism under then-Prime Minister Michael Manley. Dons like Jim Brown, Dudas's father, were armed and protected in exchange for political loyalty. This was the birth of Jamaica's garrison culture, where politicians didn't need to build infrastructure. They needed only to control votes through community enforcers. Dudas inherited this machinery and modernized it. He globalized Jamaican crime, linking Kingston's ghetto politics to the cocaine superhighways of the Americas. And for years, it worked, until the U.S. forced the reckoning. The question that still haunts Jamaica: if Dudas was so dangerous, so violent, and so deeply embedded in criminality, why did the people love him? The answer is uncomfortable, because for many, he did what the state never would. He brought order. He brought protection. He made people feel seen. And perhaps most damning of all, he was consistent. In a society where corruption runs deep, where politicians flip-flop for convenience, and where state resources rarely reach the people who need them, Dudas was dependable. Brutal, yes, but dependable. He didn't just fill a power vacuum. He filled an emotional one. Legacy or warning, today murals of Dudas have been painted over. His name is rarely spoken above a whisper, but his story hangs like smog over Jamaica's political and criminal institutions. Young dons still rise in Tivoli Gardens. Rival neighborhoods still pledge allegiance to their own political parties through guns, not ballots. The system, the one Dudas mastered, remains intact. His legacy is a warning, not a blueprint. Until Jamaica ends its addiction to garrison politics, until the state becomes more than a far-off authority for the inner-city poor, and until there is justice for the lives lost in Tivoli, there will always be another Dudas waiting in the wings. Because as history shows us, you can kill a man, but you can't kill a system that created him.